We are talking with filmmaker Deborah Coons Garcia. She is the writer, director, and producer of the new film, The Future of Food. Deborah, thanks for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Start out and tell us, what was the motivation in putting together your film, The Future of Food?
Well, I became a vegetarian in college back in the late 60s, early 70s, and I started learning about the difference between what we call now sustainable agriculture and industrial agriculture, and not only what it does to the earth, but what it does to people's bodies. So it's something that I've been aware of for many years and really kept up on. I'm kind of like this food fanatic. Luckily, I live in Marin County, California, so I can eat good organic food year-round, so I'm very fortunate. And I had always thought that it would be great to make a film that explained these issues to the average person. So I decided a few years ago that maybe this was the time to make the film. I wanted to do a really serious project, like someone that was a really absorbing project. And when I started researching it, I thought, well, now I'll do the film about agriculture and pesticides and organochlorines and xenoestrogens. I thought it was going to be about one thing, but when I started researching it, genetic engineering was obviously the big issue, that they were genetically engineering seeds and plants to be resistant to herbicides, and they were genetically engineering insecticides to be in plants, and also patenting. And so these issues that I didn't know anything about, even though I felt like I was a very well-educated, hypervigilant consumer, it had just happened under the radar. And so it became clear that I should make the film, just because I wanted people to know about it, and also because no one knew about it. Even now, there's a lot in the film besides genetic engineering, but that's a big component of it because that's such a big change. I think it's a big change. The proponents of genetic engineering say it's exactly the same. I think it's really different. So that's one of the points of the film. But yeah, so I think that it sort of came in under the radar, and right now only 30% of Americans think they've ever eaten genetically engineered food. And if they eat corn syrup or lecithin, which is in a lot of processed foods, most likely they have. So, and then when they find out that they have eaten it and it's not labeled, they're outraged. I mean, that's what the government focus groups that have, you know, they've done on this issue say, that the citizens are outraged. So I just think people need to wake up and look at the changes that are happening in the food system and before it's too late.
So talk a bit more about the degree to which genetically modified organisms have been integrated into our food. I was surprised, and I follow this, I was surprised in your film that it's like 100 million acres.
Yeah, more than that now. Yeah. Yeah, it's all over. But it's only in a few countries. Most of it's grown in the U.S. and Canada and, of course, China. There are just a few countries because Europe doesn't want it. Japan doesn't want it. But the four main crops that are genetically engineered are cotton, corn, soy, and canola, and some Hawaiian papaya, and a couple different kinds of squash that aren't really readily available. Those are the only crops that are for sale for people to eat that are genetically engineered. And 85% of the soy grown in America today is genetically engineered, and about 45% of the corn. So We all know that corn syrup is in so many things, and corn syrup is kind of a controversial issue right now anyway, with diabetes and all these things that are happening in health that people are wondering, where is it coming from? So we have this in our food, and they're genetically engineered in two ways that are available for sale. There are lots and lots of test plots, and we can talk about that later because that's its own outrage. But basically, they're genetically engineered with a bacteria. It's recombinant DNA technology, which uses DNA from bacteria and viruses to cross species boundaries, and they put bacteria into these cells. And one thing they do is called Roundup Ready plants, and they're genetically engineered with a bacteria that's naturally resistant to Roundup, which is Monsanto's herbicide. So when these are Roundup Ready, genetically engineered with this bacteria, you can spray them with Roundup over and over and over again, and they won't die. It will kill everything else green, but it won't kill those plants. So it helps the farmer with weeding, you know, so it's fast, even though it's more expensive because there's a premium on it. You have to buy the chemical. Buy the seeds, have a premium on the chemical. It's fast, and so some farmers like that because they're pushed for time because they usually have to have off-farm jobs or they don't have the kind of help they used to have. The other one is BT crops, and BT is a natural bacterial insecticide, and it's organic farmers use it, and they put it on their plants if it's needed, you know, once a season. In this case, this bacterial insecticide that kind of dissolves insects from the inside out, the target insect, is genetically engineered into every cell of those plants so that if a corn borer, which is one of the target insects, eats any part of that corn plant, it will die. So, and actually, the BT crops are registered with the EPA as an insecticide because this is in every cell. So if you're eating this corn, you know, you're getting this insecticide in every cell. So it's a really different kind of thing than using BT, for example, to spray it once a season to, you know, get rid of certain pests. So those are the two things that are available for us to eat. And then there's a lot of test plots all over the place that are proprietary, so citizens don't know where they are, and they can. There are all kinds of crops that they're testing. And one of the things that is most alarming is this thing called pharming. Pharming. You're looking at me, you've got this look on your face like, oh no. This is so funny because we're right around Thanksgiving, so everybody's thinking about food. Look at their plates and think, well, you know, if it's not organic and you're eating corn, cotton, soy, canola, you might want to know that, you know, what might be in there. But the farming plants are crops like corn or rice that are genetically engineered to create a chemical or a plastic or a vaccine, and these plants create that. And this is supposed to be a benefit because it gives farmers that would grow that crop added value. And it was supposed to be cheaper than manufacturing the plant. Spermicidal corn, they were testing that in Southern California, and apparently the company that was testing it went bankrupt. So I always imagine there's kind of like all this spermicidal corn pollen floating all around Southern California. And this is bizarre. I could talk about this on this radio station, but how they made the spermicidal corn is certain women's bodies are allergic to sperm. It's just a condition. And so what they've done is they've taken that and genetically engineered that into the corn. And there's also this rice that's genetically engineered with the human gene that creates breast milk in order to create a pharmaceutical that cures diarrhea. That's another one. They're growing test plots of that in Hawaii, right? I mean, in North Carolina, right next to it. So there is all kinds of stories about those things that you probably rather not hear. But it's good to know because it's all happening. And that's the problem a lot of people have with genetically engineered plants is that you can't contain them, and that they cross with other plants, and that they can spread, and they can contaminate other grains that are processed with them. And so that's what has a lot of people concerned, is not only that they're out there in the food supply, but that they're not labeled in the United States. So we can't choose unless you're buying organic, unless you have the opportunity and the ability to buy organic.
And even there, as we speak, they're trying to reduce the laws on organic foods.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they're trying to degrade the organic standards, which is a whole other controversial issue. And they did try, when they were establishing what the organic standards were back in the early 90s. And the Organic Standards Board, as it is now, is a bunch of different kinds of people. You know, people in the organic industry, and, you know, they're not, you know, it's not a political favors board. You know, there actually are, right now, the way it stands, there are people that are very interested in keeping organic standards pure. But what's happened now is that they're trying to open those up again and change them, and has a lot of people alarmed because everyone worked really hard to keep these standards high. And what they wanted back in the early 90s is that the government said that they wanted to allow food to be labeled organic if it had been grown with sewage sludge, or if it was genetically engineered, or if it had been irradiated. And everyone that wanted organic standards to be pure and high, everyone wrote in to the FDA, and I think there were 250,000 people wrote in. I wrote in. And so they did take those out of the standards. So fortunately, you know, it can't be called organic if it's been irradiated or if it's genetically engineered. But this new thing of opening it up, there's some problems with it. It's a controversial issue because some people in the organic food industry think they can open up and let a few things that people use for processing that are pretty harmless go through, but then a lot of other people have the concern that once it's opened up, then big industry, and organic now is a very lucrative industry, so Walmart grows organic, you know, I mean, it's all big biz now, so they want to get in there, and people are afraid they'll want to degrade the standards and kind of take what people think of as organic. You kind of think of this nice, happy, small family farm, and there are lots of wonderful farmers who do grow that, but then there's also massive industrialized organic agriculture now. And, you know, there are some wonderful dairies that have organic milk that are lovely family dairies that treat the cows well. And then there's other organic dairies that keep them all in sheds, and it's kind of a sort of a factory farm situation. And it says in the Organic Standards Act that they're supposed to have access to pasture. Well, some of these big corporations that are doing organic stuff now, access to pasture to them means that cows can look out and see a pasture. Which I don't think that's what the cows... I don't think that's the same for the cows. That's not really the same.
Well, if they have their way, they'll just, you know, they'll put up a photo of a pasture.
Yeah, right. Probably. They'll put up a photo, right, a Xerox of a pasture.
So talk about one of the people that features prominently in your film, Percy Schmeiser.
Yeah, Percy Schmeiser. Percy Schmeiser is a farmer in Saskatchewan, Canada, and he's now in his mid-70s. And about in the late 90s, he was growing canola. He's been a farmer for over 50 years. He dropped out of school during World War II when he was a teenager to grow food, you know, to help feed the troops. And so he's been a devoted farmer his whole life. And what happened, well, he's a canola farmer, and he's a seed saver. So through the years, he's collected up seeds that work well for his fields in Saskatchewan, and then he replants them. And what happened in the late 90s is he got a letter from Monsanto saying that they had found their patented Roundup Ready canola on his land, and that therefore he had breached their, they had violated their patented seed, that you can patent seeds now, and that he owed the money. And he said no, he refused to pay because he didn't plant it, he didn't want it there, and his position was this got on his land somehow. He didn't know how, his next door neighbor was growing it, stuff fell off a truck, he didn't know, but he didn't plant it there, he didn't want it there, so he figured he shouldn't have to pay. And the early courts ruled against him, and they ruled against him in the first court and the appeals court and all the way to the Supreme Court. And they said that didn't matter how it got on his land, but he had violated Monsanto's patent. And so Percy's a great hero. He's gone all over the world speaking, and he's, you know, a lot of farmers get these letters, and they all settle because they don't want to go up against Monsanto. And also because the way that the law is now, you know, if you're growing corn and your neighbor's growing genetically engineered corn and their pollen comes over and contaminates your corn, you're violating the patent of the company that owns the patent on that corn. You don't want it there. It damages your market because a lot of people don't want it, don't want GE corn. So that the ruling in Canada, the Supreme Court, which came down last year, was interesting because they told Percy, because Monsanto wanted damages from him, you know, they wanted not only for him to pay his $400,000 of legal fees, but their legal fees, and then damages to them. And what the Supreme Court said, which was interesting in Canada, they said that you can't patent a higher life form. That's what the Canadian Supreme Court ruled. Now, in America, there was a test case that came up. The Harvard mouse is genetically engineered to have a predisposition to cancer called the Onco mouse, the Harvard mouse. So it was the first animal that was patented. So it went all the way up to the Supreme Court. U.S. said, yes, you can patent the Harvard mouse. Went all the way up to the Supreme Court in Canada, they said, no, you cannot patent the Harvard mouse because it's a higher life form. So in this way, even though our court systems are similar, they're different. So everyone was watching the Percy case to see if they were going to declare plants higher life forms or not. So what they said, which was interesting, the ruling was that the plant wasn't patented, but the DNA that Monsanto had patented was patented, and that is in every cell of the plant. But the plant itself is not patented, but their DNA is still patented. So if they have their DNA in the plant, then you're violating the patent. So it's interesting to think how, you know, the plant can be patented, although the DNA is in every cell and the DNA is patented. And so that's the whole issue of patenting life, and should life be patented. And so what they said to Percy was that he would only owe Monsanto money for the increased value that this patented DNA brought to those plants, which was zero, because people don't want it. They can't sell it. So he didn't owe them money, and they also said that he should pay his legal fees and they should pay their legal fees. So as Percy says, they didn't get one red cent out of me. So it was a mixed, I mean, they did reaffirm the patent breach, but there were these other sort of side things that were kind of mixed. And the thing about Percy is that he's the most famous farmer in the world now. I mean, he's a huge hero to farmers in places like India and And he's a very colorful, very bright man, you know, because we spent several days with him, and I've seen him many times, and he's spoken on panels after the film, and his wife Louise, I mean, they're just really great. You know, they have a bunch of kids and a bunch of grandchildren. They're just completely salt of the earth. But you kind of wonder, why did Percy go up against Monsanto when all these other farmers didn't? And one reason was that Percy, for many years, represented his province in the Canadian legislature, the parliament. I guess it's a parliament there. And so he always felt, all those years that he represented Saskatchewan, that he was there for the farmers, that he was there to protect farmers. And so I think that just colored his whole outlook. And all of his farming, there was this sense of service. I mean, you know, growing things during World War II, and, you know, he had to stay there and grow things and all that, this kind of thing. There's this sense of his, there's a calling, a higher calling with Percy and farming and the land. And so he felt that when this happened to him, that this was a bad thing for all farmers. And I think that that habit of his, of all those years of trying to think, how does this affect the farmer? How does this affect farmers? So he had this kind of different point of view, and also because he had been in the legislature and he had dealt with law and he had dealt with all this stuff, that he was more likely, he was willing to take it on. And so it's good because, you know, Monsanto's, we don't even know how many of these letters Monsanto has sent out to farmers, you know, many thousands. And it's really a sad situation because, but what can you do? You know, you're going to either give them the money they want, $80,000, $100,000, $25,000, whatever they want, or else you're going to face years of litigation. And the other interesting thing that I learned recently, you know, it's all the news is kind of like, it all kind of starts filling in, is Monsanto, I knew this, Monsanto, starting in the 80s, has spent billions of dollars buying up seed companies. So Monsanto, which was originally a chemical company selling pesticides and herbicides, went into the seed business. So they've bought billions of dollars worth of seed companies, and they control most of the corn germplasm in the Western Hemisphere. They bought Seminis, which is a Mexican company that was a conglomerate, and so they now control most of the vegetable seed available for sale in the Western Hemisphere. So the other thing that I didn't realize that I learned recently was, you know, you get into this tangle with Monsanto, they can refuse to sell you seed. And, you know, for a lot of the seed, they're the only game in town. And they want the genetically engineered seed out there because it's a higher premium. And because this seed is patented, farmers can't replant it. So every year they have to go back and buy it. And farmers, there used to be protections for farmers, for breeders. They used to be able to have a license so that if they bred something, they would be protected. You know, somebody couldn't go off and, you know, get their seed and resell it. But what the exception to that was that farmers could replant those seeds, they could trade them with other farmers, and people could research them. So it kept the whole seed thing open, you know. But with these new utility patents, which is different than this plant protection license that's happened, started, you know, decades ago, it's a new deal. People can't replant it, and they have to keep going back. And it's a utility patent, and that's why this, in the whole patenting of life and patenting of DNA and patenting of human genes and patenting of animals. So they really are controlling it. And the situation with Monsanto is that, I know that, like, a farmer in Nebraska who has a certain kind of soybean that they want to plant, that they've planted for years, that works well for them, the Monsanto salesperson, who's usually, you know, some good old boy that, you know, they've dealt with for years, comes and the guy says, I would like this certain kind of soybean that I've been growing for years. And they said, well, we have that, but now it's genetically engineered. So if you want that, you're going to have to take the genetically engineered one. So even some farmers that started off against GE, didn't want it, we're pretty much forced to grow GE because there's not enough non-GE soy for everybody that wants to grow it. There's not enough organic soy for all the companies that want to source it. So it's got a really complex issue, but yeah, there's all these like weird like connections. You kind of see what a sort of insidious takeover it is of food, you know.
Right, and companies like Monsanto are buying up and patenting both the GMO as well as the natural seeds.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So once they control the seed supply, they can hold back whatever they want. They have no obligation to let out seeds. And so it does make you wonder, here's a company whose primary business was, and for a large part still is, chemicals, pesticides and herbicides. So it's not to their advantage to let out a seed that does really well and doesn't need pesticides and herbicides, you know, it's their advantage to let out a seed like the Roundup Ready that's genetically engineered, that's designed to be used with a chemical. So it's a different, you know, story. And then, you know, what is Roundup? You know, what is happening to our land with these millions and millions of acres of Roundup being sprayed, killing the fertility of the soil, you know, turning it from a live thing into a dead thing.
So one of the tactics that it appears that Monsanto and the other mega corporations is using is singling out these farmers, where these farmers don't realize that it's all the other farmers are getting targeted by Monsanto as well. And so it sounds like it's kind of a divide and conquer tactic that
yeah.
appears to be working.
Yeah, there's a few things around that. And one of the things Monsanto has done is asked farmers to rat on other farmers. You know, if they think that a farmer is growing GE, that, you know, GE crops, genetically engineered crops, and they haven't paid for it, then they should rat on them. And then they'll get a leather jacket, or they'll get special, extra special something. So that's a problem. And also the other thing is that when these farmers do settle, they're not supposed to talk about it, and they're not supposed to tell anybody about it. So they sign an agreement not to talk about the settlement. Or even, I don't know, I think maybe even that they even got a letter. But, yeah, and it does tend to create factions in the farming community, because people that are targeted for it, and we have a case in the film, Rodney Nelson, big soy farmer in North Dakota, who's just, I mean, both he and Percy, you know, they weren't organic farmers. They were just regular, you know, they used chemicals, and, you know, they were not the slightest bit, you know, radical or, you know, anything like that. They're just regular farmers. They're just doing their job. And Rodney's family got served with a lawsuit, and so they fought it because they knew they had used GE in some of their fields, but they didn't use it in all their fields. They have like a 2,000-acre, 2,000 or 3,000-acre farm there. And so they fought it when they got their letter because they knew they hadn't done it. And they're very... very straight, you know, totally square, you know, like, you know, and they fought it, and then so in the community, as Rodney says in the film, you know, people would look at them and think, you know, oh, what did they do wrong? Why are they being sued? They must have done it. Did they do it? Didn't they do it? Are they being dishonest? You know, all this stuff where they didn't do anything. They didn't do anything, and so they finally settled. But they weren't allowed to talk about the conditions of their settlement, but he still talks about what happened to him. He just can't talk about what happened in his settlement. But he's spoken out, and we have him in the film, and he's very eloquent. And he really, you know, he thought that activists, you know, my understanding of it is that he, you know, before this happened to him, he thought activists and this, you know, he thought they were just really way out there. And now he's become, you know, he's really seeing it all in a different light. And this whole loss of independence of the farmer, and we deal with that a lot in the film, how farmers are getting squeezed because the corporations that control the inputs, the seeds and the chemicals and the fertilizers and all the machinery and everything, you know, they're just these huge multi-billion dollar corporations that can really control what goes on, like controlling the seed supply. And then on the other side, who they sell to is bigger and bigger billion-dollar corporations. So the farmer in the middle is getting squeezed. You know, they're getting squeezed because the inputs, they can charge whatever they want. And then the farmers they can't sell their crop for what it costs for them to grow it. So, you know, we subsidize it. So the whole system is bizarre. And the other thing that maybe people don't realize is that 80% of the grain, you know, the corn and soy that's grown in the United States is sold to feed animals. And, you know, that's fine. I mean, I actually don't eat meat myself, but I do eat salmon, wild salmon. But we just need to start thinking about how much water we're using up doing that, how many chemicals, how many pesticides and herbicides and fungicides we're putting into the soil, that it's contaminating our water supply, and all the oil that's used up, you know, and all this agricultural machinery, and then shipping this stuff all over the place and processing it, and it's all subsidized. You know, it's all subsidized. That's why McDonald's can sell a hamburger for a dollar. And the interesting thing that didn't get out in the news much for this Katrina thing, although I thought of it, and then I read it somewhere, and I think this must be true, there's this area down off New Orleans called the Dead Zone. And what happens is that after the growing season, all the chemicals that have been used all on either side of the Mississippi, all the way up the Mississippi, all drain into the Mississippi, and pesticides, herbicides, you know, all the stuff, and drains down and clogs up with silt in the bay off New Orleans, in the Gulf of Mexico off of New Orleans. And they call it the dead zone because it's absolutely dead. There's nothing alive in it because that's what these things do. They kill. And so it washes out there, and it's just giant. It's just like as big as the state of Rhode Island. And it's floating there, like below the surface, all clogged up there. And what I read, and I believe this is true, is that because that's there right underneath the surface, when Katrina hit, the water above it, you know, the several feet of water above it, because there was this mass of stuff below it, it created this extra warm water where the heat got heated up and it couldn't disperse down into the water because here was this mass that was like collecting the heat. So the water temperature above this dead zone was like, I don't know, it's like I read it's like 98 degrees or something. I mean, it was even more than just global warming. I mean, specifically the result of the kind of agriculture that's taking place all along the Mississippi Valley. So when this Katrina storm came in, it hit this hot water. You know, as we know, that makes the storms more powerful and added to the destruction, you know, turned it into a higher rated storm. So, you know, and that's something that didn't come out, you know, oh, global warming. And that obviously global warming is very important. But here's a very specific thing that's right there that you can point to say, wow, you know, what would have been different if that bay had been healthy, if it hadn't been, you know, packed with this dead zone? That's what they call it. They call it the dead zone. So that's obviously having an effect on our citizens and, you know, our economy. And you know, we're the ones that are going to have to pay to get New Orleans back on its feet. So there are consequences of all this stuff. There are consequences. And I think people need to start becoming aware of that and then deciding whether we want to continue that, you know, because that's not going to go away unless, as a society, we decide that we want it to go away.
Well, and as you, you know, mentioned, one of the other consequences here is that the farmers, the small family farmers, who, if you go back in history, are the ones that care for the seeds, that pass on the seeds. And I was blown away in your film by the number of varieties of different things in different countries. The, what is it, 100 different types of rice in China?
Hundreds.
All the different types of things, potatoes, how many varieties there are of that, and how these are being wiped out by these monocultures.
Right. Yeah, that's a huge issue, is that we've lost an enormous number of all the different kinds of plants that were grown at the beginning of the 20th century are gone. They're lost. And they basically grow just a few kinds of big industrial crops. So this idea of diversity and diversity in seeds being a good thing, you know, I know coming from the Bay Area, there's this idea of being politically correct, like biodiversity is a good idea because it's politically correct. You know, you want to see all kinds of people, all kinds of things. And you know, that's nice, but this is actually beyond being politically correct, because what happens in the Irish potato famine is a perfect example, is that they were growing one type of potato all over Ireland and a certain blight hit it and it destroyed all those potatoes. They were gone. Within a few days, they were destroyed. So there was nothing for people to eat. So they had to go back and find a potato from South America that was naturally resistant to this blight and bring it back and start again. The same with corn in the United States. There was a corn blight, and they had to find a corn, a kind of a landrace corn, one of the early kind of a very highly differentiated kind of corn that originated in Mexico that they found was naturally resistant to the blight, and then that's what people ate. So the whole idea of keeping all our resources open, that when these diseases and these insects come, you know, if we're doing things right, the way I think it should be done, and the way a lot of plant scientists who are like-minded, is that we need to preserve all this diversity, and we need to be growing it out everywhere. And also, we can use science to find out, you know, what gene in that plant creates what trait. In other words, if you have corn that's high yielding and corn that's drought resistant, when you cross them, it's great to use science to find out, you know, did that drought resistant gene get in there, and be able to test it right away, mark and test it to see if it got in there, so you don't have to grow it out and provide a drought, you know, do all the things. You just get, so, but you breed them traditionally, but then you use science to see if the breeding that you've done has been effective. So that, I think we need to use science, but unfortunately, you know, which is again another part of the film, is that what's funded now. There's a lot of corporate funding in our academic system today, and so funding that enhances biotechnology, which can be patented, which can make money for the university and the biotech companies, you know, this is what's funded. The organic and sustainable so far has not been heavily funded, although there's a lot of activity towards that. I know the Kellogg Foundation gave UC Davis, which is an epicenter for biotech, they gave them a huge grant recently to have start a sustainable agriculture program, many millions of dollars. So everybody's really excited about that. And when the farm bill comes up next year, and they're already starting to have hearings, there are a lot of organic farmers and people interested in sustainable ag, people interested in, you know, even young people in the sciences interested in being able to be funded on these alternatives to the corporate, patented, chemical-addicted agriculture. You know, they want to get in there and get some government money in for neutral, you know, for research that benefits everybody instead of research that just benefits, you know, the Monsantos of the world. And that's something that as citizens, again, I think we need to make our voices heard, that we would rather our money go to that than to give a multimillion dollar rice farmer money and subsidies, you know, and to allow small farmers and to allow people who are trying to make the transition to less chemically dependent agriculture to support them in that.
We are talking with filmmaker Deborah Coons Garcia. She is the writer, director, and producer of the new film, The Future of Food. And I know, again, one of the people you had prominent in your film,
Ignacio Chapella, yeah.
Had suffered repercussions from his work with criticizing genetically modified organisms.
Yeah, well, Ignacio, yeah, we've become friends. He's a professor at Berkeley, and he was the one that went down to Mexico and tested the corn down there and found that it had been contaminated with genetically engineered DNA, even though they weren't supposed to even be planting it there. But it got in there because the farmers who live in Oaxaca was where this was, is they actually were selling United GE corn from the United States in their government food stores. So people would buy it to eat and they would plant some because that's what they do. And the reason why the government food stores were filled with US GE corn is because it's cheaper for Mexico to buy our corn, which is subsidized, than it is for them to grow it themselves. It's called dumping. And so it's cheaper for them to buy it from us than to grow it for themselves. So go figure that. And also because other markets don't want our GE corn. Europe doesn't want it. Japan doesn't want it. There are some African countries that don't want it. So that's a great way to get rid of this genetically engineered corn that the farmers have that they can't get rid of. So anyway, he discovered that, and he printed an article in Nature magazine. And Nature magazine, after a few months of all the biotech people freaking out, the point was it was there, and what they contested was his interpretation of some of the testing on what was going on inside the genome, which this particular kind of test, which is kind of controversial as to how you interpret the test. So they objected to his interpretation of the test, and so Nature magazine wrote an article. They didn't retract it. We say in the film that they retracted his article. It was peer-reviewed, but actually they didn't retract it. They just wrote saying we should never have published it, you know. And then a few issues later, Nature magazine was filled with, you know, it's filled with biotech ads. Although Nature Biotech magazine gave my film a positive review. I think it's the first time they'd reviewed a film. They gave the film a positive review, which is really interesting. They said people need to pay attention to this, you know. This film shows why people are concerned about GE, which was really interesting. Then the next thing for Ignacio is he had actually worked for one of these big biotech companies before he became a professor at Berkeley. So he thinks they have their place, but he doesn't think their place is in academia. So when a big biotech company offered Berkeley a $25 million grant to do specific research that was going to benefit this biotech corporation, Ignacio spoke out against it. He said, this shouldn't be here. It'll influence what we do. And so he had just started working there as a professor, but he had to speak out because he actually had worked for that very company, and he thinks it has its place. It just shouldn't be in academia. So when he came up for tenure a few years ago, And they did do the $25 million grant, and they didn't get much out of it. So they didn't hardly patent anything. So it didn't really turn out. So they didn't renew the grant. It went for 5 years, and then that was it. But Ignacio, when he came up for tenure a few years ago, it was yes, 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 all the way up, and all of a sudden, no tenure. So he was, you know, everybody, a lot of people were outraged because his peers, everyone had said yes, 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 and somehow from the powers at the top, came down no, because biotech is big money. It's big money at UC Berkeley. It's big money in the Bay Area. It's big money up here. That's where the money is, especially with pharmaceuticals. And so he worked with them. He negotiated and finally sued them. And he sued them. And then after going back and forth a few months with the lawsuit, they actually awarded him tenure several months ago. I think a new chancellor came in and looked at the situation and gave him tenure. And there were a lot of Berkeley alumni who wrote into Berkeley saying, this is really shameful, what's happened to this man. And there was an independent review of his case by a university in Michigan that looked at everything that happened, and they said, this is a clear case of bias against him. Because of, you know, this was unfair, this was unjust, because he, you know, it was tenure, yes, 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 and then all of a sudden. So everyone was really happy for Ignacio that he got tenure. And I was happy for him because he's a wonderful man, you know, and also he's exactly the kind of person that should be influencing young people, you know, because he really understands how biology works. And one of the things he says in the film, which I think is so true, and I think unless you're in that field, you might not even think about this, is that biology used to be a very diverse field, and people were able to explore all kinds of things. And now it's been cut down, it's been pruned down, so they can only do biotech. And that he felt that was a great loss, and that he was fighting against that. And I think his fight is very courageous, and I think it's allowed a lot of people in academia, certainly professors I've met as I've gone around with the film, to stand up and let people know when they've run into tenure problems because they have issues around big, giant, you know, corporate control of agriculture or various environmental things or, you know, the stuff that brings the big money in, you know, if they challenge any aspect of it, what its effect on the environment or human health or whatever, you know, immediately they're troublemakers. They're not, thank you as a society for letting us become aware of this, but you better shut up and get out. Your career is over. And you see this. And we have instances in the film where people have that, and you know, like the guy that researched that the monarch butterfly may be harmed by the genetically engineered corn, the pollen, because the milkweed is near where the corn grows. And he, out of Cornell, and he brought out his results, and he was denigrated by the industry. But he was accurate, you know, and that was a big thing. You know, you saw these people marching with all the kids had on monarch butterfly costumes, you know. It was a very wonderfully visual way of people becoming aware of how threatened things are, like the monarch butterflies. Everybody loves them, and they're way down this year. So people have run into issues, but a lot of them are courageous, and some of them are just they're gone because they didn't get tenure. So now they're, you know, working at some little podunk place, Nowheresville, and, you know, it's too bad because that's exactly what we need. We need neutral analysis of the effect of this stuff and the effect on society as a whole, not just can someone make a lot of money doing it. You know, that really shouldn't be the only question.
So I want to talk a bit about more about the solutions that you see that need to be enacted, and one of them sounds like that at the university level, we need to get our universities so that they aren't totally beholden to the corporations that are funneling in money at, you know, an ever-increasing rate.
That's definitely one part of it. Yeah, that's definitely a part of it. And also, I think that as far as what people eat, I think they need to start reading labels. I think they need to make their wishes be known to the stores they shop in. If they buy organic, then that supports that world, which is the fastest growing segment of the food industry. And I think one way to get the food issue, as far as, you know, people are going to consume, is to demand labeling. And there's a wonderful man who works here out of Seattle called, his name is Craig Winters, and he runs a group called the campaign to label GMOs. And it's thecampaign.org. And he's actually has spoken on panels with me, and the film is premiering today in Seattle, and he's going to be with me after the premiere to talk. And he's wonderful. He's just one of those guys. I love these guys. They know every answer. They just know every answer. And he's really dedicated, and his goal is to get genetically engineered food labeled, because what they've proven all over the world is if it's labeled, people won't buy it. So he's not for it. I'm not for it, but we want it labeled because they've proven that people, if it's labeled, people won't buy it. That's what they did in Europe. And I showed the film in England at the same time as the Labour Party convention was playing, and there was an MP, Alan Simpson, who came and spoke on the panel with me. And he told me this great story about how they got GE foods labeled in the European Union. In England, there's a group called the Women's Institute, and it was formed in World War I. And it's these ladies, and it has to do with gardening and all this stuff. And they had gardens, you know, like sort of the Victory Garden whole thing. So these ladies and the Women's Institute, so back in the 90s when they started having GE food, you know, GE elements in food in England, they didn't want it. And so they organized this thing where the ladies would go in to grocery stores and buy all their food, especially on a Friday afternoon when it was really busy. And they'd get to the checkout counter, and they'd say to the checkout lady, oh, you know, I want to know which of this food is genetically engineered because I don't want to buy it. So I would like to know that. So could you go through with me each of these elements, each of these foods, and we'll see, and you tell me because I want that. You know, and they were very ladylike, and all the shoppers are all piling up, and it was creating this guy, this man, or somebody called it shopping chaos, you know. I imagine these very polite ladies in their hats and their suits, you know, causing this complete. And so finally the managers of the store just said, we need it labeled. Let's just label it so people know it and they can choose it. And that was kind of the beginning of this idea that people should have a choice. And that's something that Americans, poll after poll, say they want a choice, but the government, you know, our government is so filled with corporate, you know, our government is basically a corporate socialism. You know, everyone that makes decisions in these areas are really, they're really there because they'll make the decision that benefits the corporations. So, but I think we need a labeling bill. And I think that would be great. I think that people need to figure out what's going on in their, what they call their food shed. You know, they need to find out. It's great if people can link up with a farmer near where they are, a CSA, and have a box of vegetables delivered. Farmers markets are great. Just knowing where your food is coming from and knowing what the consequences of your food choices are. You know, if you can buy apples from Washington State, that's great. Let's not buy them from China. Let's buy them from here and let the apple farmers here make a living. So that's great. And I think getting together and, you know, a sense of community and trying to feel, you know, I think gathering together and around food and for healthy food and for control of our food supply in any way is really good. Because like, people love farmers markets. I mean, that's like big deal now. And that's great because people go and they, you know, it's, I think, more fun than going to the mall. You know, go there and you can do your hunting, gathering, meet your friends. So I think that's good. But I think ultimately the issue of patenting and the issue of labeling are going to need to be dealt with through legislation. I think we need laws about that. And I think that the people that we have, our legislators now, which I see is kind of different than the government in general, you know, they've got so much on their plate. You know, they're so busy and there's so many pressing issues that they have to deal with that food somehow becomes a back burner issue because, you know, we're all being fed and there it is in front of us. Let's not create a problem. So they don't really understand the issues, and it's up to citizens to make them aware of those issues so that they can take action on it, because just something as simple as labeling, give us a choice. That's what Americans like. We like the freedom to choose. And so I think that's where it's going to start. It has to start, because it's not going to start from the top up. It's, it has to start from the grassroots. It has to be grassroots.
Yeah, it has to grow up from the soil.
That's right.
And the labeling issue has been totally fought by the large corporations whenever people have brought that up. For instance, in Oregon, I know that they had an initiative that started out doing very well, and then of course the mega corporations threw in millions and millions of dollars to defeat that.
That's right. And what their line was the pocketbook. You know, if you demand labeling, it's going to cost hundreds of dollars for each citizen per year to do that. You know, and that's really what they know. They know that people will vote their pocketbook. But, you know, Europe has labeling. It doesn't cost them anymore. You know, there's actually over a billion people in 30 countries that have their food labeled, whether it's GE or not. So, you know, I don't think we should have to accept that because it might be more expensive for them. Then just don't grow it. That's the answer, not to make us not know what we're eating. Because this stuff people don't realize about genetically engineered food, even though the proponents of it are so, you know, they have this line. Their line is, we've been doing this for thousands of years. It's been thoroughly tested. We need it to feed the world. You know, those are kind of, they have these standard things that they just keep repeating over and over again. And when you actually examine it, this stuff has not been thoroughly tested for health because it was declared substantially equivalent by the government. And so, therefore, it doesn't need to be tested or labeled. And it's not equivalent. You know, it's got pieces of bacteria and viruses. It's got, you know, all kinds of things in it. So I think that's a big thing. You know, I think we need to start, like, paying attention. Because there actually was a study that came out this week. You know, if you get hooked onto these issues, you can get on the internet and get on these great, you know, people will send you this amazing stuff from all over the world, you know, everywhere. They did, for 10 years in Australia, they were developing this genetically engineered pea because there was some kind of disease over there they were trying to fight. 10 years, they got something. They started testing on mice and found that it created lung problems in the mice. So they had to throw the whole thing out. Well, at least they tested it, right? I mean, at least they tested it. So, you know, here's a genetically engineered food that turns out created lung problems in mice. And some of the other things that people have found problems, they've found immune system problems, they've found stomach lesions, they've found difference in organ growth rate. And I think, you know, we have to wonder why are there so many immune problems these days? I mean, not only people coming up with arthritis younger and younger age, but why are there so many allergies? I mean, why, you know, my thing I learned this year, which I didn't know, is that because of food allergies, they're not allowed to have any peanuts in the New York City school system. It's because the peanut allergy, nut allergy, is so prevalent there. So I grew up in the 50s. So in the 50s, we lived on peanut butter. Okay, here we are, you know, year 2000, no peanuts allowed. What's happened in those 40 years? You know, chemicals. Who knows? GE, we don't know. We don't know, but it's obviously affecting a lot of people's lives.
And if there was labeling, then that would go a long ways towards being able to trace back the potential reasons for these allergies and these problems that people are suffering from.
Exactly. And there's evidence that when they introduced GE soy in England, before it was labeled, you know, before all this labeling, that allergies to soy went way up. You know, and they can track that there because they have a national health system. So they can track when these things happen to society. Plus, it's a smaller country. Well, in America, we don't have anything like that. So who knows? Who knows if a child gets colds all the time or a child has allergies or skin or whatever? You know, who knows what that's from? But, yeah, if it's labeled, then people can trace it.
And in getting back to one of your early points that you'd made about test plots, again, taking the example of what happened in Australia where they just went, well, we'll just throw this out now that we've discovered it's bad. These test plots, all of a sudden, if they discover that that particular item that they're growing isn't good anymore, a lot of times, like, the funding will just dry up. They won't even, like, go and, like, plow the thing under. They'll just, like, abandon it. We don't know where it is. And then it just spreads to other fields and other plants.
Yeah, that's right. I think that might have been what happened with the spermicidal corn in Southern California. I always think that's going to be, like, the turning point when all these guys think, spermicidal corn, that's the last straw. Yeah. Yeah, the test plots are pretty scary, the stuff they're coming up with. Hawaii is a real, I think, sacrifice zone for this. There are hundreds of, if not thousands, of test plots in Hawaii because they can grow things there all year round. Maybe, I don't know, some people think because then if something horrible happens, it'll be contained to Hawaii. But one of the activists there, and they've been showing the film there, like, weekly for a year. You know, they're really on it because here's this beautiful island, you know, that people come to because it's, you know, it's vacation and all this stuff. And then here's all these weird plants growing all over the place. And the citizens there filed suit to find out where these test plots were, and they won. And so they can find out where they are in these certain circumstances. But a few weeks ago, one of the activists there told me that a corporation had applied for, they wanted to grow an algae that was genetically engineered to create a chemical, like a pharmaceutical, and they wanted to grow it in the ocean there. And they were all ready to go do it. And people had to file suit, and they went to court, and a judge read it. I think it was a woman judge, and she's like, no, you cannot put algae genetically engineered to produce a chemical in the salt water of Hawaii. I mean, duh, you know? But it just goes to show really the arrogance of these people and really the inability to really comprehend the possible consequences. I mean, what if that got out? And here's all this algae growing all over the place that's producing some weird chemical in the water where you can't escape it if you're swimming. So, you know, the genetically engineered fish, genetically engineered, they genetically engineered human genes into a pig to make it bigger, and it just was horribly deformed. I mean, you know, it is a weird new world out there, and it's all happening. So people need to speak up if they don't want this to be our future, because I think it's within the next 5 or 10 years that our future is going to be decided. After a certain point, it'll be too late to go back. If they start letting out more and more crops, Monsanto hasn't brought out a new crop, GE plant, for 6 years. And that's because, I think that's because they know that if they bring it out, a lot of people now, or they're more educated, they're going to say, no, 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 and it'll kind of bring the issue up and up above, so everybody will identify it. And they were going to bring out GE wheat, and they announced, I think it was last year or the year before, that they were not going to bring out GE wheat because the wheat farmers didn't want it because they'd lose their markets. You know, they didn't want it. So, and of course, then, you know, word is that they're still trying to push through GE wheat. But, you know, so it's a battleground, you know, right now. It's a battle. And if we don't really take this action and become aware, I think what could possibly happen within 5 or 10 years is they start genetically engineering everything. They could do, when they bought Seminis, they said they weren't going to start genetically engineering all these masses of vegetable seeds, but my friends that are organic seed growers, especially up in the Northwest, you know, they were really afraid that they were going to start planting genetically engineered vegetables right near where the seed crop is grown, so it would contaminate. And then they would lose their seed crop. There wouldn't be any organic seed left. And one friend of mine was at a meeting with the Monsanto people, and Monsanto's theory now is coexistence. You know, you can have genetically engineered crop right next door to non-genetically engineered. You can coexist. Well, you can't coexist because the genetically engineered is going to cross with the non-GE. And, you know, and this friend of mine said, he said to them, well, you know that if that happens, that the GE will contaminate the non-GE. And he said this guy got this creepy smile on his face and said, yes, I know. So, you know, that's where the future could go. But on the other hand, I think, you know, people can stand up and say we don't want this as a society, like a lot of countries have, and I think that we will have a different future. And that's where the most excitement is in the food industry today, is farmers markets, CSAs, going back to this, you know, like tomatoes, you know, like 10 or 20, 15 years ago, everybody, the tomatoes were terrible. And they get this one cardboard tomato. Well, look at all the tomatoes that we have now at the end of the summer. You know, we get like 20 different kinds of tomatoes available at farmers markets. So what people want is that, you know, what the corporations want is something else. And I think the people need to be stronger.
And there are examples of successes here in the U.S., for instance, organizations like POCLAD.
Yeah.
I know just recently, and I think it was in Pennsylvania, where a bunch of municipalities threw out these agribusinesses and said, no, you can't come into our communities. We're not going to let you.
Right, right. And that's a battle, too, like these giant factory farms that have, you know, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of hogs in one place. And I mean, I think citizens need to start taking control. And again, it's something that everyone who wants to live in a community that's free of, you know, like 400,000 hogs being grown, you know, right nearby where you smell it and it's in the water, everything, you know, they all have that in common. So it is something that can bring people together, even though we live in a divisive time. I think everyone wants good quality of life, and everybody wants, you know, their families and their children, their grandchildren, to be in a world that has good, healthy food, that has real food security, you know, where you know what you're eating is going to be healthy for you, and you know that you're supporting the kind of food system that you want with family farms and healthy farms and that sort of thing.
So in addition to the different theaters that your film is showing in, I understand it's also going to be coming out on DVD soon?
It is coming out in DVD. It's coming out in December, and it'll be at the Whole Foods, and also it'll be at these some of these wonderful co-ops up here, too. And it has the film, which is 90 minutes, and on the first DVD it has two interviews with scientists called Scientists Speak Out About Safety. And then the second one, which this is new, is a special features DVD that has video on it from other filmmakers. It has portraits of four farmers from wonderful films like Troublesome Creek and My Father's Garden and Emiko Omori's film, The Farmer's Portraits, information about CSAs, farmers markets, Michael Pollan, who wrote Botany of Desire, who writes for the New York Times Magazine on the cost of food, seed saving, what else? I'm missing some things. Recipes from people like Alice Waters and Molly Katzen and Deborah Madison and some other people. And also there's a last and some other things. Then there's a last section that is called Take Action Accessing Websites. And so for this is like the latest thing. You can show it in your put it in and show it to yourself, show it on TV, or you can take it out and put it in your computer and you go to this last section and you can access all kinds of documents and information and all the websites for all the people and all the things that you've seen in the other section. So you can plug it right in and go right there and get right onto our website, thefutureoffood.com, where you can also buy that special, you know, the two DVD set. So it's really exciting because we have documents like Craig Winters from the campaign gave us a bunch of documents. And so you should actually print out from this something that you could send your congressman or your local city councilman. Oh, and the other section that's great is called Bringing Healthy Food into Schools. And we use these examples. We have a story of Santa Barbara School, and we also have the whole story of the people in Olympia, Washington, the woman in Olympia, Washington, who changed the food system there and got healthy food into that school, so how people can do that. So there's a lot of great information, and because people are always asking, you know, what can I do, what can I do? And, you know, it's great for them. And so now I have the answer. Well, you can put the second one in the computer and access everything. There's lots of reading materials. We have stuff from the Soil Association in Britain who have totally changed the whole school system, this whole school food system in England. You know, they've really thrown out the junk and brought in the healthy stuff, and they're teaching they call them the dinner ladies, how to cook real food, and the kids are eating healthy food. So they were sort of shamed into changing the food that they have in school. So we have a whole report from them on how that happened. And it's pretty exciting, I think. I'm really happy with it because my original theory with making the film, so just make the film and then people, you know, we have our website, thefutureoffood.com, where people can come and link up with other things. But I kind of figured, I'm just the filmmaker. They can watch the film and then they have to find out from, you know, they need to go to other people to find out what to do. You know, we'll tell them, we'll suggest the people, but so many people want to know what to do that I figured this was a great resource. And it was fun because there's lots of video clips on it, you know, like 10-minute movie about seed saving and a movie about the school in Santa Monica. Of course, I didn't make any of those films, which is great because I could just choose, you know, filmmakers whose work I admire, who people who were willing to go out there and do that work and make a really nice, concise, you know, 10 or 15-minute piece on it so people can kind of just sit back and watch it and enjoy it. And so it's kind of like the we call it a smorgasbord. I realize I hadn't used that word in a long time. Good food word.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We have just been talking with filmmaker Deborah Coons Garcia. She is the writer, director, and producer of the new film, The Future of Food. And you can find out more about that at their website, www.thefutureoffood.com.